Well, today we come to one of the all-time great stories in all the Bible, and it's only 4 verses long. I love this story. We're in Luke chapter 21. If you want to follow along, feel free to do that. Maybe you brought a Bible, or maybe you brought your phone Bible, or your iPad Bible, or whatever you've got, but we're in Luke 21, and I invite you to follow us. And this story that we're going to talk a little about today takes place in the last week of Jesus' life. It's the final days for him. It's near Passover time. And Jesus is teaching in the temple, and as he does, he's watching people. And one of the things he's watching, one of the things he's noticing, are the people who are lining up to come and bring their offerings and to place those in the temple treasury. And Jesus is just kind of eyeballing those. Enter the widow. The widow, one of life's minor characters. Likely no one ever sees her. She's one of the invisible people who comes and goes without anyone really noticing. Just one of the extras who stands, you know, off stage, while all the major characters move about confidently in the spotlight. But as usual, Jesus isn't really paying attention to center stage. He's more interested in what's going on in the wings. That's where his eyes are focused. And Luke goes out of his way in this story to tell us, it almost sounds like he's redundant, he tells us that she's a poor widow. Goes out of his way to say poor. And since all widows in that day and time were poor, this woman, because he goes out of the way to say that, must be absolutely destitute. We're told she has 2 copper coins, which are the smallest unit of currency in Jesus' day, and it's all she has to live on. And you know, I read this story, and I can't help but wonder, what is she thinking? She's standing in line. She's got a little time to kill. People are in line ahead of her. She's making her way forward. What is she thinking at that moment? I mean, at some point, it has to occur to her that God technically does not need her 2 coins. You know, people are there from all over, and a lot of them, frankly, are rolling in it. You know, the valets are parking their camels at that very moment. They're doing very well. And one thing's for sure, that if she gives this gift her last 2 coins, nobody's going to know. Nobody's going to notice. Her offering's not going to make a sound in the plate. Certainly not going to make a thunk, you know. Her little gift won't make any noise at all. Nobody in the whole place is going to go, wow, when she gives it. So maybe she's thinking to herself at that moment, God doesn't really need this. But also, at some point, she has to be thinking, you know, if I give this, it is totally up to God to care for me. This woman has no family, we're told that. No husband, no income, no assets, no pension plan, no safety net. This is all she has. You know, makes me think of Tom, who told his story last week in worship, you know, and thinking to himself, God, if I give this, it's on you to care for me. So Jesus sees her with her 2 coins, and I don't know, maybe it's kind of the way she's cradling them, you know, in her hand that lets him know this is it for her. This is everything she has. And she stands there, and then she opens her hand, and she lets the coins fall. And there's this tiny, thin, barely audible clink in the plate. And Jesus knows as he watches her that now she has nothing left. Her sacrifice is complete. In fact, it's so complete, Jesus calls the other disciples over and says, look at this. I'll tell you what, Jesus says. This poor widow has given by far the largest offering today. All these others made offerings, good offerings, that they will never miss. But she gave extravagantly what she couldn't afford. She gave her all. She's a percentage giver, all right, 100%. Now, really important to notice, Jesus isn't putting anybody down here. Not at all. He in no way dismisses the gifts of the wealthy. In fact, I would imagine in that beautiful temple, it was the gifts of the wealthy that, you know, that built this beautiful place. And, you know, I'm sure he's mindful of that. He simply points out that from God's perspective, this poor widow happens to be the major donor in the entire temple stewardship campaign. And this story really is just one more example of the upside-down kingdom of God, where the last shall be first and the least shall be greatest, and the most unlikely people you'll ever know turn out to have been Jesus himself in disguise. Here's something I know. I read this story, and I know that this congregation is full of people with the heart of this widow. Full of people with this widow's heart. You know what? I know, and I didn't bring mine up here. I know when you look at our trifold every week, and on the back, you know, we print numbers related to the offering. If you're like me, I came back from summer, and I looked at the number, and thought, holy cow, you know what? You know, you might be tempted to think, people aren't giving. But that is not entirely accurate. It's not. People here are more generous now than they have been in ages. In fact, in the last year, the average annual gift per giver at First Baptist Decatur increased by nearly $500. The giving average per person is the highest it's been since we began keeping records of this kind of thing. Our current issue, you know, financially, isn't that our folks aren't generous. Our folks are incredibly generous. It's just that not enough folks have become givers yet. And we're going to talk about that this fall. And we've got folks thinking about that and working on it. And more will be joining us soon. And I'm sure we're going to be fine. But our finance office tells me that currently 414 people are giving something at First Baptist Decatur. You know, some give a little, some give more. But oh my goodness, what it would mean to this congregation if 100 more, even 50 more, would take just that one step from non-giver to giver of any amount. That would be huge here. And you know, man, what a difference you would make if maybe that's up to you to take that step. This poor widow, I'm confident, doesn't think of herself in this way, but she is a kingdom person. We're talking these days about what it will mean and what it will take and what it will look like for this to happen. And do y'all remember what this is? Let me hear it. Oh, well, again, all right, with the cue. Kingdom of God to Decatur, Georgia. That is absolutely right. And one thing's for sure, it's going to take the same daring generosity of this widow and her two coins, because kingdom people don't clench. They don't. Not their hands, not their lives, not their love. Kingdom people are open with all these things in beautiful, often sacrificial ways. A lot of you in the room are familiar with the shift that's been taking place on the American religious landscape. This is not news to many of you, but things have been changing, you know? And among other things, giving trends in 2014 look vastly different than they did in 1950. A lot of observers of American religious life are proclaiming that institutional giving has come to an end as loyalty to denominations and institutions has declined, that institutional giving is a thing of the past, but while institutional giving has declined, passion giving continues to rise. It rises. More than ever, people, especially under 35, are saying, you know what, I have in my hands a finite amount of resources, and I really want to be the best manager of these resources I know how to be, and when I give some of this away, and I want to give it away because generosity is a value to me, I want my gift to matter. And I don't know about you, but that sounds a little like biblical stewardship to me. I want to be a good steward because God's given me a certain amount, and I want to be a good steward of that. A CEO of a company that tracks giving trends says that for the generation of people 32 and under, it's about identifying with a cause. For them, giving has become personal. It's become very local. And they're known as Generation Y. You know, won't surprise you to hear they're the ones that come after Generation X. And they're also called millennials. And they're born between 1982 and 2002. And there are 81 million of them. They're the fastest growing segment of the American workforce. Already out in the marketplace, tech companies, investment firms, law firms, city planners, universities recognize that as they compete for available talent, they cannot ignore the needs, the desires, the attitudes of Generation Y. This generation is tech savvy. They're family-centric. Many millennials are willing to trade a higher paycheck for more balance in their work and family life. They value diversity in virtually every area of life, and they love freedom of choice. Generation Y tends to balk at doing things the way we've always done them. And millennials are not wallflowers. They don't want to observe. They want to participate, and they want their views to carry weight. Millennials love being part of a team. They want to be included. They want to be involved. And where faith is concerned, of all the generations, none is put off by phoniness more than Generation Y. This generation demands authenticity. They resist church performance. Millennials want to be part of a conversation about faith. And they want to ask questions that don't always have predetermined answers. Millennials want to call a truce between science and faith. They want their faith communities to emphasize an allegiance to the kingdom of God over an allegiance to any political party or even to a single nation. Millennials want their gay and lesbian friends to be welcomed into their faith communities, really welcomed. Rachel Held Evans, in an interview with CNN, summed it up this way, and I recognize that, you know, there are a few millennials in the room this morning, and you know, real millennials probably resist anybody, one person standing up and speaking for all of them at the same, and I get that, I really do. But Rachel Held Evans, in an interview with CNN, summed it up this way. She said, "We want to be challenged to live lives of holiness, not only when it comes to sex, but also when it comes to living simply, caring for the poor and oppressed, pursuing reconciliation, engaging in creation care, and becoming peacemakers." She said, "You can't hand us a latte and then go about business as usual and expect us to stick around." She said, "We're not leaving the church in droves because we don't find the cool factor there. We're leaving the church because we don't find Jesus there. And like every generation before ours and every generation after, deep down, we long for Jesus." She was quick to add, actually, that these trends are true not only for millennials, but also for folks from other generations. I see some of you nodding as I'm talking today. And she says whenever she writes about this topic, she hears from 40-somethings and 50-somethings and grandmothers and Gen Xers and retirees who send her messages that say, "Me too. Me too." And you know what? Maybe you don't find a lot in this description that really identifies with you, but I'll bet it identifies with your kids and your grandkids. And you know what? Decatur is crawling with millennials. The oldest of them in this generation are 32 years old, and that just made a whole lot of us feel older than we did when we woke up this morning. 32 is the oldest. The youngest are in middle school right now. And leaders in Decatur are aware of this. That was evident to me when I watched the official welcome video from the city of Decatur, the Decatur Business Association puts out. In fact, you know what? I want to end this message today just a little differently. If you'll recall, if you were here last week, you'll remember that I asked all of us to ask ourselves, why am I at First Baptist Decatur? Why am I here? What draws me here? And then, what do we have to offer to this city we love so much? And I asked us to imagine with God what could be released from this corner if we leaned into a God-sized vision, a vision that's always expanding, a vision that releases people to serve and give and lead and create, a vision worthy of the kingdom of God. And as we imagine, I think it's probably important to pay attention to who this community is. What's important here? Why are folks moving here? What it is about Decatur that's drawing so many people, especially the young? What is it? So we're going to watch, and it's about 5 minutes long. This video is 4 years old, so it's a little bit dated. You'll recognize in places it's dated, but I think it tells us some things that are important. The leaders in our community, when they said, all right, people are going to be checking us out, what do they need to know about Decatur? This is what they came up with. And as you watch, please see what opportunities come to your mind for a church like ours in a city like this one. So friends, here's Decatur.
Decatur dates from 1823. It's an old community and actually predates Atlanta. Decatur of today is a very active and involved community. People that live here enjoy being part of the community and feeling that sense of community.
We go to the bookstores, we go to the shops, we eat, we can just have an entire day here.
We have a lot of festivals in Decatur. We have the book festival, we have the arts festival, we have the beer festival, beach party, we have the concert series, which is in May and September. There's always something going on.
We've become the largest independent book festival in the country and one of the five largest overall. Jonathan Franzen kicked off his international tour right here in Decatur, Georgia. There was a time when I had to explain to the publishing world where Decatur even was. I don't have to do that anymore. They know that this is a town that loves books, that loves authors, that treats authors like rock stars when they're here.
Llama Llama Red Pajama reads a story with his mama.
It's one of the best festivals I've ever been to. There's so much going on and such great people and so much enthusiasm.
Decatur's known as a city of schools, homes, and places of worship. But I think in the last 10 or 15 years, you can certainly add to that shops and restaurants. Businesses that are successful in Decatur are the ones that do things just a little different.
My family's been involved with four thriving businesses in Decatur since 1995. Three restaurants, one boutique. One thing that's really unique about business in Decatur is that I don't feel like other stores or other restaurants are competition. It's just a part of the group.
We have about a little over 200 bottle beers and 24 drafts, and the drafts change constantly. And then we have beer from all over. You know, it's primarily the bulk of our list nowadays is American craft and Belgian beer. We've been voted one of the top 5 or 10 or 25 in the country. And on a couple of them voted one of the best beer bars in the world.
People call it Mayberry meets Berkeley, and that's really what it is.
We try to create an atmosphere where creative people feel free to work and operate and do whatever it is they do. And the example of that is Eddie's Attic.
It's always a thrill when I see someone that played here in the early stages of the career, like John Mayer or Sugarland, Jennifer Nettles and Christian Bush, or Sean Mullins, or the Indigo Girls, Amy Ray and Emily Sellers, when they go on to a bigger and higher platform.
It was a great springboard for the early parts of our career, and we still play there. We played there recently, did a couple nights, so it's just home.
Last Tuesday evening, we had a visit from John Mayer, and I met him at the back door, and he had this little coy smile 45 minutes after he tweeted, and there was already a couple hundred folks.
We certainly got some of the best restaurants And we got a restaurant that last year was voted one of the top 10 new restaurants in the country.
We're a farm-to-table restaurant, the freshest, best produce that can be grown in and around the Atlanta area. Is center of the plate for us, and we accompany it with a meat or seafood and or vegetarian option.
After we'd sort of taken off and achieved a certain amount of success, there was a juncture, and I had three other partners, and we just decided we wanted to open a business. We thought, well, Decatur needs a restaurant, a mom-and-pop restaurant that is committed to its southern roots.
Always feel welcome no matter who you are, and it's just such an engaging place to be.
I think the biggest reason Decatur's blown up, they not only had a plan in place that said they wanted a walkable, livable, safe community, they wanted to deal with small local businesses.
When I talk to presidents, CEOs of other creative companies, I tell them, you need to be in Decatur, because it is a perfect environment for that kind of company.
It's historic, but it has a vibrancy about it that talks about the future.
We have preserved the neighborhoods. Our school system is now stronger than ever. And it's just a great place to live, and I think it's at one of its best points in its history.
It's already a model for many small cities. I think we're going to become a model for big cities.
It's a great community of people who love the arts, love good food, and love their neighbors. That kind of sums it up.
So what did you notice in that video? And you know what, maybe there were some things that were not in the video that you kind of wished had been. And so I want to ask you to talk about this amongst yourselves. You know, and you can watch this on YouTube if you want to pull it back up again, if you wanted to see it. Again, 2 weeks from today, I'm gonna talk specifically about vision and what that could be. I want to engage our deacons in about 10 days from now. And so we're going to be talking about that. And this video maybe will play a good part in our wondering what could be as we move forward. But today, I want us to leave all that, and I want to bring us back to the temple where a destitute widow has just given everything she has, and there's Jesus watching her. And here's the thing. When Jesus leaves the temple that day, his public ministry is over. This is it. In 4 days, he'll be dead, having given up the last 2 copper coins of his life. And maybe, you know what, maybe that's why he notices her that day in the first place, because it's the end for her. It's the end for him, too. She's holding back nothing from God. He's holding back nothing from God. And when he looks at her, maybe it's like looking at a reflection of himself. So clear, he calls his disciples over to see it, and he says, look, guys, this is what I've been talking about all along. She embodies God's joyful, scary, liberating call to sacrificial love in this world. And so we're invited again to a table of such a love and to be nourished again by our most generous Christ. I want to invite those who are serving this morning to make your way to the stations. There'll be 10 stations around the room, in the front, in the middle, up in the balcony, I believe. And you're invited in a minute when we call you to the tables to exit your pew on the right, on the organ side, and return on the left, just to kind of help things move ahead. And we'll be dipping the bread into the cup when we come today. And if anyone would find communion in your seat to be helpful for you, just lift up your hands. When folks have been served, everybody will be